Well, we're going to get started in a little while, but let me welcome everybody. This is not the last talk of the semester, but it is the next to the last talk of the semester. And we did have a little bit of a connection with many talks. We had a theorist talking about Higgs and future physics, Ed Berger, theory division head. We also had Nebraska University professor talking about results from CERN for the Higgs. Today we're going to hear about another experiment on the at the CERN. It's, you probably haven't even heard of this because it's called the Totem Experiment. But there's about six experiments at the CERN LHC. And this one is the smallest of them all, but that doesn't mean the least important. And it has a connection with my own experiment because we're doing complementary work of cross sections, but at the Fermilab fixed target energies, 2 GeV to 100 GeV. So today's speaker is Marco Bozzo from Genoa University in Italy, as well as one of the co-spokesmen of the Totem Experiment. And he's going to present recent results from the Totem Experiment at CERN.
Okay, good afternoon. Yes, Totem is one of the six experiments at CERN. It's not the smallest, next to smallest one. The smallest is LHCF, which measured at the beginning of the Terrane forward production of neutron particles. We are quite small. In fact, I think, when I had the slide, we are, the entire experiment, to build the entire experiment was only about 7 million Swiss francs, or $7 million, when you calculate the darkness of CMS, about 1 million, okay, at the end. So it's a Totem means total cross section and elastic scattering measurement, and it's an experiment that wants to measure with high precision the total cross section at the LHC. High precision, we aim to get the value of systematics less than 1%, or the order of 1%. As you see here, we have started a little bit. I will just speak about the experiment just to introduce a bit more. I show you how we need some special runs of the LHC, and then I go through some results. And then for people who may be interested, we have some kind of a program which is on the way, of which we already see, and we can show you which are potentialities at least of our experiment. Well, this is the kind of physics we want to do. On the top left corner, you have, by the end of the seminar, you see the old table, okay, compilation of all the total cross-section data, and there will be also an object point here. We do it. We do elastic scattering, okay, where the proton goes unseen. And this is the formula we want to use. This is the relationship, the optical theory relationship between the total cross-section, the extrapolation of the differential rate to t equals zero. Okay, this is the obvious definition. And then you come here that by extrapolating the differential elastic rate to t equals zero, measuring the total rate, you can get the value of sigma tot independent of the luminosity, which is difficult to measure, at least to calculate, and we see it. So Totem is essentially two different experiments. One that measures elastic scattering, and one that wants to measure the total inelastic rate. To this end, we need two sets of detectors, two simultaneous experiments. For those who have seen it, this is a one quarter of CMS. We are located in IP5. In fact, we are inside CMS. I don't know if you are familiar with this. We go. These are the Newman chamber built by the American collaborator. This is the interaction point. This is the calorimeter. We are filling up a cone which before was empty. Also, because of very high luminosity, it's practically impossible to have detector working properly here. In fact, totally measuring large cross sections. We expect a cross section 100 millibar. We just need very low luminosity, low rate. So one part of Totem is the RT1, the second part is T2. And then, if this is this big picture is a small dot, 220 meters after on the beam pipe, we have the Roman pots, we have two stations. These squares are the magnet that separates the beam, and these are the quadrupoles already to take the beam. These are experiments, very briefly about T1 and T2. These are, it's a telescope of a CSC chamber with cathode slip readout. The see diameter is about 2 meters. These are gem detectors, diameter is about 50 centimeters. And these are the very small silicon detector. The active area detector is less than 4 centimeters, which will be installed in the vacuum pump galaxy. These two parallel pipes all wrapped up are the inlines of galaxy. Where we stayed, okay, so this is the picture you probably can locate. We are buried inside there over here, and then 200 meters away, we have the Roman pot. Let's look at the Roman pot. Roman pot is a name that comes from an old time. It was 1971 at the ISR. And to move the detector close to the beam once the beam is stable and circulating, the idea came of making some kind of movable sets of the entrance of the vacuum pipe. And it was done by Rome Group in 1971 at the ISR. And the name stuck and been used since to all the other accelerators. We have three. We have one that moves in the horizontal plane and two from called vertical pots from above and below. In this system, we also added a beam position monitor, so that allows us to tell us exactly where the beam is, because we want to go very, very close. In fact, for some of the data presented here, we managed to get the bottom of the pot, okay, the stainless steel window that's still here, to less than for about 4.5 sigma of the, or sigma is the root mean square of the dimension of the beam. We need to go, and I will show you next day why, to go very close to the beam. So we have to develop a set of silicon detectors. You can read about that, which are essentially 100% efficiency, less around 50 micron from the, what they call the mechanical edge, from the edge that you touch on the silicon plate, with some kind of special ring guard. So this is where we have installed. We have one unit here and one unit there for about 4 or 5 meters apart, and this is called the Roman pot station. I don't know why there is this total 100 there, but we take it out. Very rapidly, well, at a certain moment when you go to very small scattering angle, the nuclear elastic scattering cross-section becomes smaller than Coulomb scattering. And so this is also a point that you can measure these two parts here automatically. You may have an absolute normalization, so you don't need to go and measure the luminosity machine of other things. In reality, we will be able to measure, we need a very special optics. We have to go to very, very low T, and this is values for 14 TV. So essentially, we stop here, so we have to extrapolate to T equals 0 in the elastic. But the point is that to measure very small scattering angle, you need also to know with very high precision the direction of the particle coming to you. And this, in a machine, means that you need a large beta star. So we need a special optic. In fact, in a machine, the angular spread, sigma theta star, is proportional to the square root of the emittance divided by beta. So by making the beta, which is a value essentially connected to the size of the beam locally, to make beta large, you get a very small spread. So if we had designed in our proposal an optics that wants a beta of 1.5 kilometers, almost 1 mile, while, for example, at the moment LHC is working with beta 1.5 meter, and they would like to go more. Beta also tells you, say, beta is more, the beam is more, and all the particles are concentrated, luminosity goes up. So we, in fact, we want, and we like to pay the price in lower luminosity. The idea of our measurement, in fact, is that if the beam becomes big, then you say, oh yes, you know exactly the incident direction, but you don't know where you started from, because the beam size becomes quite big, 0.4 millimeters. So this is a design of the trajectory of our optics, and you see that all the trajectories, but they start with the same angle at the interaction point. After a while, they find themselves in the same point. And this is the, in between here we have the lenses of the insertion, machine insertion quadruples, and we call this a parallel two-point focusing, as in a normal lens. So if you essentially you see your Roman pot or your detector in this plate, you see that the beam, which was very big at the beginning, can be made small. So by getting sufficiently close to the beam, you can measure a very small angle. And the position at your detector is essentially all you need because it gives you the angle. Okay? This divided by this gives you the angle of the trajectory. So this is how we put our detectors. Now I think you saw slightly our semi-funny shaped silicon detector. I show you at three Roman pots and then it's going to be like this in such a way that the horizontal one overlaps the vertical one. So we have also possibility of measuring exactly the distance between the two when we do the measurement, also because the distance between the two defines is essentially proportional to two times the scattering angle. Okay? And so you can use it to calibrate exactly the angle and reduce errors. So this is the optics that we have now, only 3.5 meter, and is slightly different than the other one. So you see that one effective length stays large. The other one goes essentially to zero. So in the y direction, we lost this. We can go back a moment. In the y direction, the position, the angle is given by the position of the detector divided by this effective length. For theta x, since the Lx is zero, we have to count to the fact that there is the way this goes to zero, and it's slightly less precise. But we see what this means. This is a standard schematic. We have quadruple focusing and defocusing and magnets to it. This is essentially the this is the first event we saw. These detectors are essentially 400 meters apart, and these are the tracks. We have 10 planes, what we call U and V coordinates. You saw that the switch goes to an angle, 45 degrees, and this was the essentially the first thing we saw. But from then on, it was this June, essentially June 2010, that we got the permission to move in. We've seen many more. In October 2010, we had a long run, always a 3.5 meters, so it's low beta if you want, and we could take data. We could move the pot to not very close yet, they were still very conservative, to 7 sigma, and this is what we measure. This picture here, which is the one you probably already seen also in the Saint Courier, if you follow this kind of publication, it's the hits of the proton on sector 5-6 on the left top arm and on the bottom right arm. And these are the ones we have the data. We reconstruct the track, just one track through one telescope, and all the tracks then go to fill up, populate this. So we have, you can already see here, some tracks in the center that essentially you see their galactic scattering. And then we have tracks that this direction, how do you read it? Okay, this direction, essentially, there are the protons that lost some energy, and psi increases this way, or the t increases the other way. So this is going to be essentially the main elastic part, and this the other one. This is because our optics, we said, is sort of asymmetric. Okay, Lx is equal to zero, so in x, we see only. Sorry. I'm giving you sort of the details to try to make such a, you can then follow me. This is the, when we have these tracks, then we ask those tracks that you saw, those detectors, we go and reconstruct the collinearity in Y and in X. X, so this essentially is a mark of the fact that our detector cannot get too close to the beam. The beam is passing through here. And this shape is that because this is an angle and modifies this. And this is the other projection. We cut the 3 sigma and what we see, though, right? Can we say this part here essentially is y? Because given that Lx is zero, we see essentially the beam size and interaction point. So this is the essentially should be proportional to the to the beam divergence. In fact, this is missing acceptance, and this the thickness of this curve gives us the beam divergence. This is just to show you, we went to check and we cut out the 50, 60 micron of the edge of the detector. You can, okay, this is an angle, but you can reconstruct how much it is, and it's very close, and the detector becomes very uniformly efficient. And, so this is the what we remove for our acceptance correction. In phi, okay, this is again the angle that's explained why this is a bit flat like this. And you see that the small t, we have a little bit, lots of correction to make here, much less there. And this is the correction factor we cut at the level of 30%, and not more, so that's how we calculate the background. The background, we, which is also t-dependent, we see it, from here. At different t's, we just make the slice here, and you see this sort of big splotch, circular splotch here, essentially, is a real background. And when we do all these cuts, this is in the center part, and we see that this distribution with the tail can be fit perfectly in these two Gaussian. This is the background, and this is the signal. And then, okay, do a different thing. Then we find out that this is the background, and this is the raw data, the way we see it. So the background, I think, is calculated, and we know that around 1 GeV is 8%. You can see here the percentage, but the 0.5 GeV, there is a dip, so the value in percentage gets larger. We do also lots of checks about the efficiency. I think it's probably not a case to go through, but you see that after the efficiency, reconstruction efficiency of the detector is quite good. The correction is a few percent, and it's uniform all along the measuring range. Another important point is to know exactly how your spectrometer works. Okay? We have 0.5 quadrupoles and 2 bending megahertz between interaction point and us, so we have really to calculate exactly, to know exactly what it is. They cannot just use the machine parameters, so we try to fit everything together. In addition, we have our detector, which are there, and they define the coordinate system. Also, they can be rotated, detector can be rotated to each other, and the remote particles. Finally, we fit all together, and we get a very good understanding of the logics, which is our strength, and in fact, we measure some machine parameter to better than the machine does it. And in fact, they said, it's good, we should have Roman pots everywhere to try to know rapidly exactly what the machine does. Again, another check we made, which makes us very sure of our data, is our elastic scattering is one particle goes up, the other goes down in our experiment, or vice versa. And these are, you can say, these are two separate experiments. And so if you select the particle that goes down, up, or up, down, and you just superimpose after all the checks, you put them there, and this, you see that our two experiments are not independent, but they're different, and our data, so we see that we don't have a systematic from up and down, because it's the so finally, these are the final data. We proton-proton elastic scattering at 7 TeV in the center of mass, and we see this dip here. Sub value of t to the minus 8. The dip is this position, We get this fit here, but it's not very relevant to any particular theory. I will discuss this a bit later when I also have the other data from large data. In fact, now that you have seen more, I think confident looking what it looks like and what we have to do, we said go rapidly to large beta. It, in June 2011, finally, machine after we proven that we could take something interesting out of the data we took at small beta, they started developing the large beta. Machine has not really implemented in practice the very large beta of approximately 1 mile, which is 1 in hour proposal, which is still valid, but we had studied with them, in fact, Helmut Burker and André Verdier previously in 2005, just came with the idea of not really making something very sophisticated, but something that can be easily reached from beginning. For people who you are familiar with machine has a certain optical injection, and then essentially they squeeze the beam to make the luminosity go up. So we decide, okay, we're going to do the opposite. We use the injection optics, so the machine does not have to study a completely new way of injecting protons for us in the machine. And we, what we call here, we unsqueeze. Okay? So this is the usual plot you see. The green line is the current into the magnet, which is proportional to the energy. You start at 450 GeV, you go to 510. Red and blue is the intensity and the number of protons in the bunches. And here we put the value of the beta through the squeezing. And the first time they did it, it didn't take them very long, it took about 2 hours with some stops to see how the machine was behaving for the very first time. So we got easily to 90 meters. They did the machine development, was only 2 bunches. Note that today the bunches are 1300 in machine, approximately. We have 10 to the 10 proton. They each bunch used by CMS of Atlas, and well, 10 to the 13. So the luminosity is 10 to the 36, while today in our machine works with 10 to the 33 or above that regularly. But low intensity, low luminosity means the pile up is very small. If you want to calculate, to measure the total rate, you don't want to have the pile up, otherwise you have to go and measure that, so that's something. Roman Pot were still far away, and Sigma, they didn't let us get close because we had to certify and to really check the beam losses for a long time. We didn't have time, but we took some data. And that was very interesting. So this is the picture that you saw at the beginning. This time I had to draw the outline of our detector because the machine at high beta with low and few bunches was very, very clean. If you remember before, it was all blue, and blue essentially there were protons. They were just getting there probably through our detector, through our arm, and they were just faking a proton, and maybe it was a beam gas, other stuff. The beta is large, so in one direction, DL is big, so you see that the elastic scattering looks like it's going much farther up. On the other side, we still have one direction where LX, the effective length, is practically zero, so we just see only the dispersion and a few event up there. This is the similar plots as before, okay? It's a different, this time is a different beam dispersion that gives us the thickness of this part, and we can bring those things. Now, if I try to go and see which is the beam divergence, which is the width of those distribution we saw before, this time I do really, you see this is, it's PDF, while we measure 2.5 microradian, while it's beta of 3.4 meter, we have found 12, 13 microradians, so that's very clear. This is again the acceptance. This time it looks flat because here, okay, they plotted length instead of an angle, but you have good physicists, you know how to change and to adapt your way of seeing. These are the cut at in phi, we cut at 30%. It has a shape like this because now everything is much enlarged, if you want to say, this sort of microscope, and we start seeing the shape of the vacuum pipe at the place where this really, what is called the aperture limit inside on quadrupole, and you see that the vacuum pipe, you know, it's round and flat at the bottom and below, and so we see it here, and this explained why then our acceptance correction certain moment goes up the other side. Again, this is the efficiency I showed before. It's a simple calculation. If you want, we do all the uncorrelated. We have four pots on the track, so we can take those tracks and see how many times we have only three. One is missing because of the showering in the window of the Roman pot or other reasons. And these are the data that we took a small t. So this is, we are in the region that is just described by e to the minus b e. This is our limit of 2 × 10⁻²⁰ g, and this is our data. What I did here, what we did here, is that since we had published some data before, which were not too far away in t, but we just plot the same data here, and without doing any kind of adjustment, just the absolute scale is correct, and you see that the new data are fitting very well on the old one, so they really match perfectly well. At this moment, we can extrapolate t equals t equals zero, and we found what is the value that we will use to calculate the cross section, and we can calculate how much of the elastic cross section, okay, which is the, this is the end. The n over dt, so the number of the events under this curve will give me elastic cross section. This is the part that is measured, and then this part due to the extrapolation. We already have to, we are already quite close to have a good knowledge. This is again what we said before. We need the optical theorem, but this time we haven't used yet our inelastic detector, T1 and T2, the one that gives us a total rate. So the one that can really allow us to evaluate L to be put here. So we took the luminosity, which is needed to go from the N to the T or the sigma to the T here, from CMS, which has a large error, which is essentially our final large error coming from the luminosity. And we took rho, the ratio of the imaginary, the real to the imaginary part of the scattering amplitudes, from, there is a collaboration that has fitted all the data available against the network. So this is value sigma tot, and then I remember sigma tot is sigma elastic plus sigma inelastic, that's by definition. So, first of all, okay, all the sigma are correct. This is the slope, 20, okay. The sigma, the LTT we saw before, and we get the value of the total cross section, 98.3 millibar. It's 0.2 statistical error, so you see that only a very short run at good luminosity. But we still have a fairly large systematic error of 2.7 millibar. And this is the systematic from. At this stage, okay, we have sigma elastic and sigma tot. We can try to calculate sigma inelastic, and we find this value here, okay. 73.5 plus minus 0.6. Now, it's interesting to compare the value, the measured value of the total of the inelastic cross section with the published value of the inelastic cross section published with CMS Atlas and ALICE, which they all had to do some kind of model-dependent assumption because they measure a particle in the Fora director. They have a trigger. They trigger only on particle with a certain energy or characteristic. And you see that all this data are about 6-7% of error minimum, while we are quite small, 5-1% error. So this is quite good. So this is a new compilation. You see, these are the total value here with the error, This is for the elastic, the elastic perception also put it there. It's some kind of, these are minds that guide the eyes, essentially. This is the paraphysical. Well, this is the best for feet that exists. This point here is the point recently published by Auger about from supposing certain ratio of proton and helium atoms and the Glauber theory, such as most of the error is due the way the Glauber theory is being applied to it. But anyway, you see everything matches very well. So this is the elastic has to be compared with this. And this value was the total elastic. This is the old fly eyes from the 70s, the 80s, the cosmic ray expected. So you see that slowly the two are matching. For the people who are interested to know, this is the value of the slope, B. I'll come shortly to discuss about that. And you see that from the energy of the ISR, B, this is the collider, this is the tevatron, okay, it's different precision, but it's the scepterizing, and this arrives very B. B essentially is how they describe the proton structure. We just, it's still phenomenological. There is no dynamic theory. Eh? So slowly the idea is that the proton gets blacker and bigger. And so the B, essentially the increasing of B is as the value of the other, the square of the radius of the proton is also increasing. Okay? And so this is what's happening all the way up. At a certain moment there are some bounds which are supposed to set in, but we are not yet there. I think we are still not here. And there are some people that claim that the saturation is already being reached, but I do not believe that. This, to make a discussion, in fact, there is a difference between proton-proton and proton-antiproton. So I put here all the proton-proton data, which we had, essentially from the ISR. The ISR was a energy in the center of mass, which is about 100 times smaller than what we found. At the ISR, you see that the dips are in this sort of diffractive structure of the proton was already seen. Yeah? This is seen, if you see the proton as a system that diffracts, okay, this distribution here essentially gives us the. But the new value of the dip we have is here, while at the ISR was essentially above 1.5, and in fact, if you go and do some calculation, the position of the dip is inversely proportional to the total cross section, which is correct because cross section has grown a lot. And then, if you go and look with the antiproton were done both at the ISR. This is the collider, 546630, and 1800 GV is the tevatron. Now, when you do proton-antiproton, there is a difference. We see the break, or what is called the shoulder, but you do not see a very precise dip. And we told them, doing proton-proton, since now it's, what, about 40 years later than the ISR, we saw again that, let's see if I go back. No, I don't have it here, maybe I have it further down. We saw again a dip. Another thing which is interesting, there are lots of models, in fact, that had foreseen there was a dip, and they tried to get also the energy behavior of the thing. So these are, we took some model available, which has been recently updated, essentially the model for which we had a analytic formula, so we could just really redesign and put them on our cross-section. And this is what we find. Well, our data fall somewhat in between, but the blue and the pink, Burrelli and Petrov, which essentially have a sort of Petrov, I think it's triple Pomeron, I think the Pomeron exchange seems to be the one they describe the better way to shape. But yet, they're still off by a certain amount of energy. And in fact, our systematic error, I think we've shown on the first slide, is not sufficient to explain this. If you want, here I put the number random to each one of these collaboration and what we measure, and you see that essentially Petrov seems to be very good. It's interesting to point at the slope at larger T beyond the thing. This was postulated by Lanshoff a long time ago, that it should go as T to the minus 8. And he could explain that is the triple gluon exchange, so it's slowly getting at least at large T to go into some QCD description of the elastic scale. Diffractive physics and cross-section. So the other kind of effect when we have to specialize a little bit on this part, when we go and look, try to count how many inelastic events, total rate, we have also to get the inelastic part. Now, the diffractive events are a sizable fraction of the total interaction, so we have to try to describe. Here is just essentially the normal non-diffractive event and color exchange, and this is get here, it's a quite color break apart. In the case of diffractive, the particle retain the quantum numbers and only just one breaks up the diffractive link, and this is the diffractive part, you just reconcile still as a individual product. This is again to try to see what we expect to see. This is a generic formula. This is the size of this is magnification plus the size of the beam at the interaction point. This is the effective length at the angle, which you already saw. We typically try to put the magnification as close to zero as possible, such a way to have to deal only these angles. But okay, when this is zero and this is zero, we are left with the psi delta P sub P, and this is the dispersion of the machine, i.e. the bending magnets in here in the bottom part. If beta is small, the beam is small, so essentially we see only this part here. If the beta is large and the beam is large, then okay, this doesn't hold anymore, and we see that all the diffractively the protons are not elastic scattered, they also get distributed somewhat wider. Okay, so this may deteriorate the reconstruction resolution, but it's good because we will be able to see them very easily in our detector. Again, some sketches to explain what I'm going to show you. About that, a large fraction is non-diffracting inelastic. We have 25 millibar of elastic scattering. Single diffraction, one side the other, is again 10 millibar. We have double diffraction when you break both protons, but yet they don't fill up the gap in the middle. This is eta, that's a log of the tangent, the log of the tangent of the angle. And so this is, you see, there is a big gap rapidity. We have double polar exchange, where the two protons go away and something gets formed in the central region, which is quite interesting. And then, okay, but these are multi-jets. Now, we can measure most of the quantities. In fact, for the first category, single diffraction, low psi, okay, we have events in which we saw that we have only one proton in one arm and nothing on the other side, yet we have detectors T1 and T2, which are at larger angle. So if I select an event, this is a low psi, we said it's just close to x equals 0, so low psi, and so I have an event in the normal plot, nothing on the other side. What do I have in my T2 detector? Well, I have, in many cases, in all the cases I have this, I can see particle on one side, which matches this sort of scheme here. So we have low psi, a large rapidity gap, so most of the particles should be out on the other side. If I select instead a proton which has a large psi, you see that I move towards this direction, the psi larger, the rapidity gap is minus log of psi gets smaller, and then I see particle in both quadrants. Okay, so the rapidity gap is smaller, yet nothing on the other side. More interesting when I have double Pomeroy exchanges, that the two protons go over and what they exchange Pomeroy and the Pomeroy is create MPP, which is measured MPP squared xion say 2 on the energy center one. And we have rapidity gap. Now if I order small xi, large xi, I have smaller and larger rapidity gap. In this case, we are using the LHC as a Pomeroy-Pomeroy collider, if you want, or gluon-gluon in another description. So this we see I have a small psi proton here, this last pair, and I have a large psi proton on the other side, and then I have events only on one side, and here the rapidity gap is large, gets empty, and there is some empty. This is interesting because we can try to reconstruct the Pomeroy exchange masses. Okay? So this is the mass inside psi-1 theta. But as a joke, somebody presented last summer at the European Physical Society, and I was asked, do you see the Higgs there? Yeah, well, maybe. No, that's a joke. No, this is just a sort of... We see that we can really do something very, very... well, we have now to go and polish it and get you all convinced that we do it nicely as we did for the elastic sketch. However, October 11th, so it was about a month ago, we managed to get, hopefully, it was supposed to be a better and longer large beta run, a 90 meter. Didn't turn out exactly like this, but we got some more data and we could get really much closer. I said before, the data I showed you before were with Roman plot at 7 sigma, now this time we get down to 4.8. This is interesting, this is very preliminary because we don't have time, but as you see, the picture is again very clean, and you see, I can show you all the angular correlation, you've seen it, there is some stuff there. Again, this time we get the resolution, which essentially is the resolution of the Roman plot here. The raw data is this. What's the interest of this? But we plot extending the low T limit from 210 to the minus 2 to 610 to the minus 3. So after we're going to do the correction, this will be heavy. But one thing which is I show it here because it's more relevant in our qualitative talk about the double Pomeroy exchange. Okay, we have some protein, one arm protein, the other one. What happens if I select the one that they go, for example, or up, up, or down, down, to be really double Pomeroy exchange proton. And this is what we find. And we haven't put any correction yet, but we see a very nice T distribution, and we can give you the double Pomeroy exchange distribution of the integrating side, which is promising because it's going to be an interesting. If I have a few more minutes, we plan to do something with CMS. We are inside CMS, and if you go and look the eta coverage, CMS is pink and we are the blue part. For the charged particles, essentially our T1 and T2 detector cover the same rapidity range as CMS. If you go to the question of energy flux, we have no calorimeters, so CMS goes a bit larger, but we have the Roman plots at fairly high. Here we also try to, this is when the beta equal 90, so if you go to my length, we just can go to larger eta even more. Beta equal 90, we get here, and this green band is tries to describe the 0 degree calorimeter, which our friend Michael Murray built for CO and other people built for CMS. Now what we try to take data together. Well, there's some technical aspects, because if you have a Roman plot 220 meters apart, the proton has to travel 220 meters, and then the signal has to be seen by the detector to make a trigger, they have to come back together and go to the counting room. So, with the time that the latencies of CMS should be barely possible if we, instead of doing the modern things of sending data through optical fiber, we use still what we call an electrical cable, a coaxial cable. It's high speed, and then this is will be totally implemented by next shutdown. But in the meantime, the idea is that we want to try to measure things like this, and for the moment, CMS sends us a trigger, and then we take data with them. This was done a couple of weeks ago, and was tested and working very, very nicely. And well, this brings my seminar to the end. I would like definitely need to thank the people from LHC, because without their patience, this would have not been really possible. And also we have to thank CMS, because our total cross-section measurement was possible because they gave us the value of the luminosity. So these are published data, EPL and EPL. So this is essentially all I prepared for you. So
questions, discussion, ideas?
What's a Palmer on? I was going to ask that
exactly. Well, it's a particle that the how do you call it, the quantum number of the vacuum. And there is a Palmer on and other if you want to go. One exchange. Pomeron is even, Oderon is odd, because Oderon comes in when they do they try to do this phenomenological theory for proton antiproton, for example. So they say that the Oderon is essentially responsible for filling up this gap.
Is it constructed out of quarks or gluons or something?
Well, I don't think it's known. It's definitely the two proton when they pass each other and they exchange something.
Virtual.
So it's a virtual, yeah, it's a virtual particle. And here we pretend, when I show you the distribution there, we pretend we see that particle now. And knowing how it behaves, maybe this helps in getting some better idea of what's going on there.
So you can't really break these things down into individual interactions with quarks and gluons.
No, it doesn't actually exist as a free particle. It's a exchange mechanism for the
And, well, there is no theory, at least to my knowledge, that explains why the three quarks and the gluon inside the proton give our elastic scattering the way it is, or give out the total cross-section. So at the moment, all that you see there is still electromagnetism. You see partial wave amplitude. You see that you want to preserve unitarity. So there are certain general bounds called the Fraser bound, which are not yet reached completely. So when I spoke about saturation, I mentioned that was the part. But essentially, the phenomenological description we have is that. That's why we have 5, 6. I got only the most important one, in fact. I knew that, but when you publish it, you cannot just publish zillions of, just publish the most recent. These are the models. I hope that we get, by looking at those phenomenologies, you can get better model, maybe with less parameters in it, and then
so presumably, if you really understood non-perturbative QCD, you could.
Yes, as I said, there was an effort. There was something which, in fact, I tried to underscore it because, to me, it's very interesting. Is what Peter Lanchot said already the year immediately after the ISR. He had observed that the ISR, maybe I go back to the.
A lot of people might not know the ISR was a.
ISR, intersecting storage ring, was the first.
CERN, colliding protons and antiprotons.
A machine which was similar to RIG, only now RIG is used for the ion physics. And see, at the ISR, it was observed, this here, they're all, the dip is moving in the slope here is increasing. But here, essentially, we were having eta to the minus 8. You see, eta to the minus 8, it's already written here. And Lanshoff said that if he says, okay, when the protons are far away, they exchange three gluons. Okay, this is the elastic scattering under QCD, according to him, and they should go as e to the t minus 8. Now, this value is essentially still there, at least within the errors, when you go factor 100 up in energy, okay, from 60 GeV in the center of mass, now we have 7 GeV, okay, so there is a factor of 100 there. So it's, I think that this will help or will tell some theories to explore also this part here, because it might be, it's good. If it is true, it's going to be good, because it's probably the first moment in which we did.
This is a nice talk that shows how a small set of data on this very large accelerator can do some very interesting insight into physics.
No, it was amazing, because in fact I was
7 million.
Huh? Sorry?
You said it was only $7 million, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's very small.
Well, I was on the authors of this measurement when I was just a young postdoc 40 years ago. And I can also tell you that the LHC is a machine which is built to be collider storage ring, not like the collider, which was a bit something refurbished as, or Teratron. And the cleanliness of the beam is incredible. So there's a very large cross section. No background allows us to use very little time. And the high luminosity on the other side allowed us to go very rapidly to go to values, so that we have some data which are analyzing, maybe very soon we're just going to make the entire range from 3, 10 to the minus 3 to 3, 4 GB square in T. Farther up, I think it will not be possible because of the limitation of the vacuum pipe. ISR was good because of the vacuum pipe, which was enormous, even if the energy was smaller, but it was very big. Here, the collider and the vacuum pipe, which is the relevant part, is 3-4 centimeters thick, and then divide by 2, I think that the quadrupoles cannot take more of that. But it would be.
Other questions? Well, our next speaker is going to be talking about upgrades to the CERN LHC program to do an even better search for the Higgs and other new physics, and how what the CMS experiment needs. Will you be doing any upgrades in that?
Well, we have already 20 tune our detectors, because we were accounting for the luminosity of the LHC to come up much slower. So we already did some tests to try to tune better the parameters of the electronics. So we already gained a factor of 5 or 7. We may rebuild some of the T1 and T2 detectors to have them to be more resilient, because at the moment we can, obviously this physics, you can do it only when the interaction probability is less or a value of 1%. Now the LHC goes and each bunch crossing, they have about 8 to 10 interaction, so that you cannot just do sort of inclusive physics, not knowing where you're coming from. So sometimes the machine makes two bunches which are small, and the rest 1300 which are huge. So you just can go and select the small and the small to do this kind of physics. However, if our detector, which are slow gas detector, cannot stand the average rate of particle through it, it cannot work. So that's a little bit of the catch. We may be redoing some detectors. Again, our development program, it's very small.
Any last questions, discussion items? Well, let's thank our speaker again. Remind the faculty, we moved this talk forward a half hour so the faculty could go to the reception for the Professor of the Year, Ron Mattson, which starts 5 minutes.